You don't have to be a diplomat to know that good food can bring people together. The U.S. State Department is doing that with their new diplomatic culinary partnership that sends American chefs abroad and brings international chefs here. Now, recently, one of these visiting delegations spent the day in Portland, Oregon, where they learned about America and all its diversity through its food. This was before Portland suffered its drinking water problems. Dina Prichip was with the chefs and filed this report.
Most of us will happily sing the praises of a favorite regional dish, whether it's a New York bagel or Minnesota sweet corn. But in the rest of the world, American cuisine doesn't always have the best reputation.
I'm really surprised because I thought Americans only eat fast food.
Samira Hariri is the head of Slow Food Morocco. She's riding around with chefs and food professionals from Algeria, Egypt, and Oman as part of the State Department's Culinary Exchange Program. They're meeting their American counterparts in cities from New York to Portland to New Orleans. And they're definitely seeing more than fast food.
She's asking, why do you sell the cactus leaves? Decoration, I guess, huh?
No, you eat them.
Oh, you eat them.
At New Seasons, a local Portland natural market, the group walks through aisles of organic produce. And they marvel at a shelf of hummus flavored with everything from chipotle peppers to roasted garlic. Not what you'd find in the Middle East.
It's usually plain and you season it by yourself.
Yeah.
Olive oil, that's main.
Hamdi Metwali El-Kawas is the head of sales for a few Egyptian grocery stores, and he's especially excited to find the bread aisle. He notes that these staple foods are actually interwoven with politics.
Actually, in Egypt, bread, that was the first motto of the revolution. Because bread means life, the same word, Aish.
But beyond this bigger picture, he's also using the trip to reflect on some of the more day-to-day logistics.
The layout here is really interesting. Like cheese and bread, like together in the same place. Maybe this will affect our next store, you know?
When the group tours Elephant's Delicatessen, manager Nick Doty walks them through the central kitchen, comparing ingredient costs and profit margins.
We try and sit around right around 30% cost of goods,
that's,
roughly.
It's all over, yeah.
It's everybody, about the same.
Yeah.
But they also just want to talk food.
One of my favorite things from Algeria, merguez sausage.
Merguez, yeah.
It's the greatest thing ever.
Back on the bus, visitors scroll through their tablet computers, looking over photos and taking down notes. But more than ideas for store layout or amazement at our portion sizes, these visitors are coming away with a different picture of America. Algerian pastry chef Yahya Nawal says that food helps shape this picture because it's so basic to who we are, even from the very beginning.
Like a woman delivers a baby, the very first thing he'll be looking for is food. And when we are traveling around, visiting other countries, first thing we'll be looking for is food.
And when you find American food, in all its diversity, you find America.
Through food, you can understand the cultures.
Ashraf Abdu runs the Egyptian Chefs Association.
And with the culture, you can understand the people. In our countries, it's a negative idea about the Americans. Because they saw only that is in the media, they didn't know the people themselves.
And the hope is that getting to know people and their culture sets the table for a very basic level of diplomacy. Getting a taste of who we are. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichip in Portland, Oregon.
The entire state of California is in a drought, one of the most severe on record. And since California grows a big share of the country's vegetables and nuts, you might think that we'd be feeling the effects across the U.S. But so far, the drought has not created shortages, nor is it driving up food prices. NPR's Dan Charles explains why.
95% of America's broccoli grows in California, 81% of its carrots, 99% of the country's artichokes, almonds, and walnuts. Even in a normal year, it doesn't rain much where those crops grow. So farmers typically get water from far away, mostly from melting snowpack in the mountains, delivered through aqueducts and canals. Southwest of Fresno, those systems are run by the Westlands Water District.
We have a Westlands outlet right here.
Sarah Wolf is showing me around her family's land. She's pointing to a big blue pipe coming right out of the ground. It's her farm's lifeline.
All Westlands growers get their water out of standpipes just like this. All of Westlands' delivery system is underground in pipelines. And a blue outlet pops up like this on everyone's field.
But this year, no water is coming out of that pipe. Because of the drought, the entire Westlands Irrigation District, 600,000 acres of farmland, has been cut off. One result is a field of bare dirt.
Actually, it had onions in it last year, and we're not farming it at all because we don't have enough water supply.
But that's not the whole story here. About half the fields in this area still are green. I see alfalfa, garlic plants, leafy almond orchards. They exist because many farmers here have a backup supply of water. They're pumping it out of underground aquifers. And this is the first and biggest reason why you're still getting plenty of vegetables and nuts from California this year. According to researchers at the University of California, Davis, farmers are pumping so much extra water from wells, it will make up for about 75% of the cutbacks in water from dams and reservoirs. But it comes at a cost. There's a limited supply of that groundwater. Sarah Wolf tells me just this morning she heard about problems at one of their wells.
We have to actually drill down and drop the well deeper, which is a very bad sign.
So the water table is dropping?
Yes. So we have to go down deeper to get it.
The second reason why the drought is not driving up food prices is some places in California have not actually been hit very hard. Daniel Sumner, an economist at the University of California, Davis, says take this example, the Salinas Valley, a place that people call America's salad bowl.
In June, 90% of the lettuce in the United States is grown in the Salinas Valley. No effect of this drought yet in the Salinas Valley.
Those farms don't get water from the reservoirs. They've always been able to rely on wells, and nothing's changed this year. And finally, reason number three. California's farmers are doing a kind of triage on their crops. Alan Peterson, for example, he farms near the town of Turlock. He grows mostly almonds, or almonds, as many people here call them.
Here we're approaching the canal system that we have delivering water to us and other farms.
The canal runs right past his orchard. It's a concrete channel 18 feet wide and 6 feet deep, full of water. Peterson is getting less water this year, about half the normal allotment. It's enough to grow a crop, but not on every acre.
I've kept water on our almond crop, which is a higher value crop. I've left fallow some corn ground to make sure I have enough water for my almonds.
That means he won't have corn to sell to his dairy farmer neighbors. Dairy farmers are suffering from the drought. They're bringing in feed from far away, and it's expensive. Farmers in California also are growing less rice. But the effect of all that on consumers will be muted. Those foods come from lots of places, not just California. Daniel Sumner, the agricultural economist, says this is economics in action.
People move the water to its highest value use. People pay attention to markets. If you can't get something from California, there are a few other suppliers where it's available. That's what markets do. They're good at it.
But if the drought continues into next year, some of these coping strategies eventually may not work so well. For instance, there's increasing talk in California that farmers really should not be allowed to pump unlimited amounts of water from underground aquifers. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Last week, our Hidden Kitchens series chronicled the communal kitchens of revolutionary Russia. 10 to 12 families living together, cooking in and sharing one kitchen. Today, the Kitchen Sisters, producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, take us to the middle years of the Soviet Union after the death of Stalin. This is when the Soviet Union changed its future by changing the Soviet home. Thousands of new family apartments were constructed, this time with individual kitchens, and those new private home kitchens became hotbeds of politics, literature, and protest.
Communal kitchen was a war zone. During the Stalin time, it was the most dangerous place to be in the kitchen.
After Khrushchev came to power, people started moving out from their communal flats into these separate flats. Khrushchev introduced this completely new era. It was called a thaw, and for a reason.
Like in the winter, when you have a lot of snow, but some spots are green, new grasses coming. It was a little bit more liberal than before. Very good time for inspiration.
When my father came to the power, he proclaimed that it will be mass construction of the apartment buildings, where in each apartment will be live only one family. The small kitchen, small bathroom. I'm Sergei Khrushchev, retired professor from Brown University. My father was Nikita Khrushchev, the head of the Soviet Union from 1953 to 1964.
Khrushchev apartments, they're called Khrushchevki. Five-story buildings, concrete panels, horribly built, very small kitchens.
No matter how tiny it was yours. My name is Masha Karp from Leningrad. I worked for the Russian service of the BBC. This kitchen was the place where they finally could get together with their friends and talk at home without fearing the neighbors in the communal flat.
One of the reasons why kitchen culture developed in Russia is because there were no places to meet. I'm Edward Chandrovich, venture investor. I'm also a Russian poet. You couldn't have political discussions in public. At your workplace, you couldn't go to cafes. They were state-controlled. A kitchen became a place where Russian culture kept living, untouched by the regime. It was the beginning of dissident kitchens.
Kitchen was for an intimate circle of your close friends, and kitchen was relatively safe. I'm Alexander Janis, Russian writer and radio journalist. First of all, when you came to kitchen, you put on the table some vodka and you put something from your balcony, like pickled mushrooms, something pickled. Sour is the taste of Russia. And you just start talking. Kitchens became debating societies. People would crowd over that kitchen table, huddle there. Sometimes there would be KGB agents stationed in the stairwells. During those times, we expected to be arrested any night.
Облака плывут, облака, не спеша плывут, как кино.
We ate plenty of bread, canned food like sprats, a lot of vodka. Tongues got looser. My name is Grisha Freidin, professor of Russian literature at Stanford University. Even to this day, political windbaggery is referred to as kitchen table talk.
After politics, literature. Samizdat.
Samizdat means self-publishing. A lot of literature was banned, couldn't be published or read openly. It was published on people's typewriters, distributed through kitchens.
You put your carbon paper in typewriter, you type the whole book. It wasn't easy to get typewriter too, because all typewriters must be registered in KGB.
A friend of mine got hold of a typewritten copy of Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. It was 1973. She said, I'm reading it at night, I can't let it out of my hands, but you can come to my kitchen and read it here. So I read it in 4 afternoons.
The same thing that happened with Samizdat books happened with music. It's called Magnitizdat, recording on tape recorder. Some friend got it from another friend, and so on. The most famous was Vladimir Vysotsky, who was Bob Dylan of Russia. That's what you can listen in kitchen.
Usually it was the Western music that they wanted to copy. Before the tape recorders, they used X-ray film and record music on the X-ray of bones, bone music.
Every kitchen has its own radio. It was a window to the freedom.
The Voice of America and BBC. My name is Vladimir Voinovich. My books were circulated in Samizdat, smuggled to abroad. Then foreign radio stations broadcasted it. I heard in the kitchen some BBC was reading my chapters. After that, I was immediately summoned to KGB.
My name is Yuli Kim. I'm writer and composer.
Я сочинил музыкальную пьесу.
I wrote this cycle of songs called Moscow Kitchens, telling a story of a group in the 50s and the 60s that are called dissidents. How they began to get together, how it led to protests, how they were detained, forced to leave the country. This is how this subversive thought grew and expanded in the Soviet Union, beginning with free discussions at the kitchens.
Чайка на пирожковая блинная, кабинеты азартный притон.
A tea house, a pie house, a pancake house, a study, a gambling dive, a living room, a parlor, a ballroom, and a saloon for a passing by drunkard, the home for a visiting bard to crash for a night. This is a Moscow kitchen, 10 square meters, housing 100 guests.
Hidden Kitchens is produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Charles Maines and also Jim McKee. You can see those dissident kitchen musicians and also see pictures of those Soviet songs recorded on X-rays of bones. It's all at our website, npr.org.
Ой, сколько вас раскушено под хильку и бычка, и в грязный угол сгружено на долгие века.
First Lady Michelle Obama is by far one of the most popular political figures in America because she's largely avoided appearing too political. Instead, she's devoted much of her attention to encouraging good nutrition and healthy lifestyles for America's children. But that cause has run head-on into a congressional fight over the school lunch program. And as NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports, that means today the First Lady got political.
As First Lady Michelle Obama sees it, the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010 is working. Childhood obesity has begun to tick down, and kids are eating more fruits and vegetables in their school cafeterias.
We're starting to move the curve on this.
But, she says, the healthy menu changes are being threatened by Congress.
You know, this is unacceptable. It's unacceptable to me not just as First Lady, but as a mother.
And she's fighting back. Today, Mrs. Obama met with school nutrition directors from districts that like the new menu standards. And she's taking a very public stand against congressional efforts to offer districts waivers or otherwise change the rules.
We have to be willing to fight the hard fight now. This is what I tell myself. In 10 or 20 years, I don't want to look back with regret and think that we gave up on our kids because we felt like this thing was too hard or too expensive. We owe our kids way more than that.
The lobbying on school lunch rules began well before the 2010 legislation passed. In 2011, food companies succeeded at getting legislative language to make tomato sauce on frozen pizza count as a vegetable. Now the argument is over whole grains and sodium, and while you're at it, the whole mandatory fruit or vegetable thing. But it isn't as simple as industry versus the health of children. At a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing last week, Alabama Republican Robert Aderholt talked about a provision he was offering to give some districts a temporary waiver from the lunch rules.
I continually hear from my schools in Alabama about the challenges and the costs they're facing and their desperation for flexibility and relief so that they can operate a program that serves healthy food that the kids will eat.
The chief operations officer for the St. Paul Public Schools, Jean Ronnie, says currently half of all grains served in her district's cafeteria have to be whole grains. But soon that will jump to 100%.
We would like some flexibility to be able to offer some items that might not be whole grain.
Ronnie is also vice president of the School Nutrition Association. That group represents school food administrators and also gets money from food service companies. She says schools in the South are struggling to figure out whole grain biscuits or grits.
We've got a lot of students that are coming to us used to having white rice, basmati rice, white tortilla shells. And while it's certainly something to be able to offer whole grains, it would be nice that we could once in a while offer some of those things that students are more accustomed to.
And she says there's another problem with the current rules. Kids just don't want to eat their vegetables. But now schools are required to make students take at least one serving of fruits or veggies.
So what might happen is if it's not a popular item, then it goes in the trash can once they've gone through the cashier line.
The National School Boards Association is chiming in, too, calling for changes to the lunch rules. For her part, the First Lady suggests discussing ways to make the nutrition standards work for all schools, rather than talking about rolling them back. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.